Hey, good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Have a good Halloween. Huh? A lot of trick-or-treating. I'm about maxed out on those little Baby Ruth bars. God, I love them. You know, I realize that the Glenn Becks and the Virginia Foxes and the Michelle Bachmans and the Sarah Palins are really kind of incidental to anybody's life. I mean, these people are kind of, you know, kind of like a joke. And I also realize that probably most of us have been taking them way too seriously. I'm going to try to back off because these are crazy people, and to focus as much attention as they get on crazy people is just insane. A good example is watching Overman earlier this evening, and Chris Wallace on Fox had an interview with Rush Limbaugh, and Overman had some highlights. And as I'm sitting there watching, I'm thinking, why does it matter what these people think? And in the immediate past, my answer was because they're powerful. They're changing the complexion where it concerns politics in America. And I don't think that that's the case. I think the United States has been drifting towards a kind of totalitarian democracy or a new kind of fascism for a long time, certainly preceding these clowns. But I guess the bottom line is I'm just so sick of taking these people seriously. There's so many important things going on that, you know, these farts on the wind, such as is Limbaugh and Beck and the rest of them, it's really kind of silly, if not ridiculous, to focus too much. Having said all that, in the race to Crazyville, you know, you got to wonder who's going to win, especially where it concerns members of the House, the U.S. House. Jesus God, there are some psychopaths in there. I mean, really, some really crazy people. So, who do you think is going to win? The current matchup is between Michelle Slitteris Bachman or Virginia healthcare terrorists Fox. Thanks to Media Matters for this clip. This is where the wacko, fading Southern Belle, Representative Virginia Fox, from she's a Republican of North Carolina's 5th District. That's Winston-Salem and Mount Airy. She explains that on the floor of the House, that Obama's health care bill poses a greater threat to America than do the terrorists. Now, this is a woman who earlier this year called the Matthew Shepard beating and murder a hoax. And I don't know. It's just crazy. Listen to this. Here she is, ladies and gentlemen, Representative Virginia Fox.
And I believe that the greatest fear that we all should have to our freedom comes from this room, this very room, and what may happen later this week in terms of a tax increase bill masquerading as a health care bill. I believe we have more to fear from the potential of that bill passing than we do from any terrorist right now in any country.
Well, if that's not spitting and urinating all over the memories and the graves of all those people who died in the attack on this country, delivered to this country by George Bush and Dick Cheney, I don't know what is. How do these people get away with this? Was saying this stuff. Oh, well. Moving along. Over the weekend, I think it was Friday, released to the public as a result of a lawsuit, of course, it always takes a lawsuit, is the transcript of the questions and the answers from Dick Cheney where it concerned the Valerie Plame case. This is an FBI interview summary of Dick Cheney's answers. Now, it's being covered all over the place. Fire Dog Lake, blog site, Newsweek, what's the name? David Corn at Mother Jones. It's not, I don't think, so far getting a tremendous amount of play in so-called mainstream media. Federal prosecutor, remember Patrick Fitzgerald, remember him? He famously declared at the end of his investigation of the Plame affair that, quote, there is a cloud over the vice president, end quote. Well, the release of this summary last Friday of Cheney's answers in the criminal investigation, you know, cast some light on why Fitzgerald felt that way. And when you look at some of this stuff, and it's all available online, you start to wonder where's the perjury charge? Now, the only way there couldn't be a perjury charge is if, once again, Cheney, this criminal son of a bitch, agreed to testify only if he wasn't under oath, which allowed him the leeway to lie. Remember, all Republicans lie, every Republican, but Republican politicians, the higher up the food chain, the more they lie. They're also cowards and snakes. Cheney had no problem tossing Irving Libby, his buddy, under the bus when it came time to do that. So if there's no perjury, how about obstruction of justice? How about lying to federal prosecutors? You know, that's there are some people with Arabic names right now or Muslim names in the United States who are either in jail or released on heavy bail because they lied or they're charged with lying to FBI investigators. Remember why Martha Stewart went to jail? Do you? No. Wasn't insider training. No. Had nothing to do with that. She went to jail for those months because she lied to FBI questioners. Now, Dick Cheney, of course, is above all that. Cheney can lie to anybody. He is a filthy son of a bitch who ran this country into the ground and continues to try to do so. On 72 occasions, according to this 28-page FBI summary, Cheney said he didn't remember about the Plame affair. Didn't remember what he said to Scooter. I'm sorry, Irving. Scooter is a child's name. What he said to Irving Libby. He couldn't remember what he said to Judith Miller at the New York Times. Couldn't remember what he said to George Bush. Couldn't remember anything. 72 times during this interview. As the AP reports, the Cheney interview reflects a team of prosecutors and FBI agents trying to find out whether the leaks of Plame CIA identity were orchestrated at the highest level of the White House, that means Dick Cheney, and carried out by, among others, Irving Lewis Libby, Cheney's chief of staff. Now, among the most basic questions for Cheney in that probe, how did Libby find out that the wife of Bush administration war critic Joe Wilson worked at the CIA? Libby's own handwritten notes suggested that Libby found out from Cheney. Well, of course. But when Libby discovered Cheney's reference to Plame and the CIA in his notes, notes that Libby knew he would soon have to turn over to the FBI, Libby went to the vice president, probably in late September, early October 2003. Sharing the information with Cheney was in itself an unusual step at the outset of a criminal investigation in which potential White House witnesses were being ordered by their superiors not to talk to each other about the Plame affair. Libby says he told the vice president, quote, "It turns out that I have a note that I had heard about Plame's identity from you," end quote. And what did Cheney say in response? Fitzgerald asked Libby in front of a federal grand jury 6 months later. Libby replied, "He didn't say much. You know, he said something about from me," something like that, and tilted his head, something he does commonly, and that was that, end quote. Now, Cheney's version of the conversation is related in the FBI interview summary. Cheney, quote, "cannot recall Libby telling him how he first heard of Valerie Wilson. Valerie Plame Wilson. Is it possible Libby may have learned about Valerie Wilson's employment from the vice president? But the vice president has no specific recollection of such a conversation? A lying, criminal, son of a bitch. Dick Cheney.
You are now entering a flying monkey-free zone.
21 past the hour. So the transcript of the FBI questioning of Dick Cheney in the Valerie Plame affair, it goes right to the heart of what Republicans are and what Dick Cheney is. And this guy has the audacity to be out there saying all his evil crap about the current president. It's astonishing. Cheney can't recall 72 times during the questioning, according to this 28-page FBI summary. Cheney said he didn't know, he couldn't remember, couldn't think of it clearly. On another basic point, Cheney simply refused to answer. Fitzgerald had gathered evidence that Cheney apparently persuaded Bush to hurriedly declassify portions of a pre-war national intelligence estimate on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This declassification was followed by Libby providing the information to a New York Times reporter. You suppose that was Judith Wilson? While simultaneously talking to reporters about Plame's CIA identity. As Fitzgerald pressed the issue in the FBI interview, Cheney refused to confirm any discussion with Bush, saying that he must refrain from commenting about any private or privileged conversations he may have had with the president. It was an instance of Libby, who had testified 2 months earlier to a federal grand jury, being more forthcoming than Cheney. Prosecutors obtained information about the leaking of the declassified national intelligence estimate from Cheney's chief of staff, Libby, who testified that he had talked to New York Times reporter Judith Miller about the NIE following the president's approval relayed to me through the vice president. What does it mean when we had for 8 years a president who was an idiot and a vice president who is a malevolent liar? What do you do with that? I mean, how does the republic survive? Well, ultimately, it does not. It doesn't survive. Michael Isikoff, writing in Newsweek, says that when the FBI questioned Vice President Cheney about his knowledge of the leak, Cheney proved to be an uncooperative witness. He repeatedly claimed memory loss on key questions, refused to answer others because they involved privileged conversations, and complained that he was pressed for time. He didn't have time to sit there and go through this with an FBI investigation. Just like he had better things to do when he sought and received 6 deferments when it was time for his ass to take up a weapon and go fight the Viet Cong. Remember that? He is a liar and a coward. An absolute, I mean, there's no equivocation here. An absolute liar and a coward. In the end, Isikoff writes, he rejected a standard FBI request that he not discuss his testimony with other witnesses in the case. Well, Cheney couldn't wait to get out of there so he could fill in the people who would also be questioned about what he said so that everything would coordinate. It's astonishing. Cheney made little secret of his disdain for key players in the saga. The CIA, he said it was amateur hour at the CIA. Because in this one particular instance, they wouldn't lie for him. He kind of gave the finger to the media, including Newsweek, and apparently the FBI agents who'd been authorized to investigate the matter. Cheney told the FBI when he was questioned about the agency's decision to dispatch former Ambassador Joe Wilson to Niger to look into claims that were phony and fake and a lie that Hussein was buying yellow cake uranium. Regarding that, Cheney said it was amateur hour at the CIA. See, this was all in the summer of 2003. And Cheney and this disgusting little twit George W. Bush were bound and determined to unleash the fires of hell against the people of Iraq in order to secure not just the oil, but all those lucrative government contracts that Dick Cheney's Kellogg, Brown, and Root could then cheat and lie and steal while our soldiers died. Cheney is a goddamn murderer. He's a war criminal. This guy just so desperately needs to be brought to trial, as does George W. Bush. Both of these people, if these two scum existed in their present shape in any other country that we were sending billions to and trying to undermine their system, we would demand that these two either be brought to trial or terminated with extreme prejudice, the way they did the premier of South Vietnam during the Kennedy years. But because they're here, and because we live in the United States 2009, these swine, these war criminals, Dick Cheney and George Bush, can get away with anything. Unbelievable.
I'm sure that Europe is a lovely place to visit. My wife would love to go there every single year. But they're just lovely. Yep. They need to stop their yips on big dogs over here. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male American and free.
Before the hour. So according to this summary, 28-page FBI summary of how Dick Cheney gave his finger to anyone who was in the immediate area when he was questioned about the Plame affair, 72 times he lied, said he didn't remember. Of course he remembers. In addition to the lying, according to Michael Isikoff at Newsweek, Cheney declined to answer questions about declassification because he didn't want to share, quote, potentially privileged conversations between himself and the president, end quote. See, that's the fallback position for these criminals. But when it was clarified for Cheney that he wasn't being asked about that, he was only being asked about what he had discussed with Libby, not the president, he still refused to answer. He just told the FBI to go screw itself. You know, get out of my face. I'm not telling you anything. The report said, or the summary said, I should say, quote, Vice President Cheney repeated his assertion that he must refrain from commenting to the investigators about any private and or privileged conversations he may have had with the president. And when they clarified, I said, no, it was Libby. He just kept repeating himself. He just sat there like a goddamn Stalinist and just kept repeating himself. And it was right around that time that Cheney began complaining that he was pressed for time. Here's a sitting vice president of the United States being questioned about his criminal activity. Criminal activity that has led to the deaths of thousands of American soldiers, tens of thousands of civilians in Iraq. And this filthy scum says, I'm pressed for time. I don't think I can answer any more of your questions. He then refused the FBI's request that he sign a waiver that would allow reporters to talk about confidential discussions they might have had with him. You know, more witnesses. Fitzgerald wanted Cheney to release these reporters.
I'm sorry, could you?
From any kind of shield law that might be in effect. And he wouldn't do it. He refused to sign a waiver saying, yeah, they can talk about discussions I had with them. He also refused the FBI's request that he promised that he would not discuss the subject of his testimony with any other witnesses in the case. They requested him? And again, he told them to go F themselves. He'd talk about any of this. You know, he's the vice president, Dick Cheney. He runs the country. And on that point, the interview with Dick Cheney ended. He ended it. Now, I don't know about you. Maybe all this stuff is just incidental. It doesn't mean anything. It has no intrinsic value whatsoever. The United States of America continues to move towards a kind of democratic fascism, if that's not a contradiction in terms. And there apparently is really no way to stop it. The Obama administration is not stopping it at all. We remain what we were pretty much when Obama was a candidate. We remain a nation involved in two wars, one of which we are going to increase our presence and step up the killing and the death. And we have no business being there. The Obama administration is carrying on with surveillance of American subject or American citizens, might as well be subjects, American citizens. As Kathy wrote in her blog today at MikeMolloy.com, as reported by Salon.com, there's no let up. Cases where civilians have brought charges, have brought civil suits, I believe. Wasn't it civil suits, Kathy, is what you mentioned? Civil suits against the government for spying on them for no reason. The Obama administration, through Eric Holder, is requesting the courts to just drop the charge, just drop it, deep six it. So, you know, at the same time, and this is part I don't get from the pigs in the right-wing media, Obama is assisting in moving the country towards that kind of totalitarian state that the wealthy right-wingers in media want. He's assisting. And they label him a socialist. They label him my God, could there be a clearer example than what Barack Obama is providing, that he's just continuing, for the most part, the policies put in place by the Bush crime family? If you disagree with that, please call. Tell me where you see that Obama is trying to stem this fascist tide that is taking over the country. I don't see it. I really don't. As far as Jamie writes, Mike, the Nation reporter John Nichols said in an interview today that when he interviewed Dick Cheney for a book a couple of years ago, Cheney had no problem recalling the most trivial as well as significant details from his past, including dates and meetings from political positions he held in the 1960s. Of course, Cheney's a traitor and a liar and a war criminal. And prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald fell flat on his face on this one, no question about it. He, Fitzgerald, is almost as culpable as those who committed the crimes, in my opinion. Nichols' book is Dick, the Man Who Is President. So, like I say, it's kind of silly to rail against this stuff, right? When you have a federal prosecutor, granted, he was he worked in the Cheney Bush Justice Department. So what's Patrick Fitzgerald going to do? There's no such thing. It doesn't exist of honor among Republicans, especially office holders, whether elected or appointed. It doesn't exist. There is no honor. There is no decency. There is no ethical conduct. Nothing. And as far as the people who support those office holders, they're even worse. They're lower. They are the kind of people that represent the stuff you scrape off your shoe when you've walked through a cow pasture after a heavy rain. I used to think it was frightening to witness all this, but I've changed my mind. It's not frightening. It's comedic in a very sick kind of way. I don't know if this Democratic Republic will survive through, you know, through all this. I have no idea. But the fact is, and I defy anyone to suggest otherwise, the fact is we are moving toward this totalitarian control that, you know, I thought we had fought against. We've sent millions of Americans to their deaths fighting against totalitarianism. Millions. Literally. Fighting against not just totalitarian, but authoritarian. You know, we've tried to, I think, in various periods in our history, tried to live up to the ideals anyway, or the thoughts, or something that was in the framers' minds, although they were hypocrites too. I mean, when you take a look at, you know, the country that they declared was going to exist, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, except the Negroes, except the Indians, except the women, except the bonded servants, except, you know, when one realizes that the country was founded not just in the slavery and the genocide, but also in utter, absolute, clearly definition of hypocrisy, then why is it a surprise to liberals or progressives that it's collapsing now? You know, the experiment was laid out there, and I'm not so sure that the experiment was really laid out there the way we all would like to believe it was. You know, when one of the framers famously said, was it Franklin? We've given you a republic. See if you can maintain it or hold on to it. I wonder if that wasn't said in jest. Now, I understand that some of the writers of the Constitution were aware of the hypocrisy when they wrote that all men are created equal. They were aware of it. They were aware that slavery was an abomination. But it apparently didn't matter enough that they would declare slavery not to be a part of this republic when they put it together. So it's just, I don't know. I don't know if you have difficulty with all this. I do. It's a never ending struggle to me, to try to reconcile all this stuff and think, well, you know, we're so close. We're just moving very slowly, inexorably into totalitarianism.
It's more Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. Well, by the way, for the podcast subscribers, there is a new Malloy's Uncensored Mailbag that is up at the website. This one is, you know, as degenerate as most of them, so you may want to check it out. Go to MikeMolloy.com, sign in, do your password, whatever, and there it is. A new Malloy's Uncensored Mail Bag for those of you who are subscribers. And if you're not a subscriber, we sure would appreciate your assistance here. No, we don't ask for charitable contributions, but, you know, the main thing that keeps the program going right now are these podcast subscriptions. So if you want the program to continue and can afford it, understand if you can't afford it. Now's the time to subscribe. You get the Uncensored Mailbag plus commercial-free podcast downloads, a whole year of them. And just a quick note of thanks to the people who continue to send in these gift podcast subscriptions. I don't know. Are we supposed to name names, Kathy, or just... I'm not sure. I had mixed feelings about this. The a new Navy assault ship, the New York, sailed into that city's harbor today. It was built with steel from the World Trade Center when it was destroyed. I don't know. The ship cost $1 billion to build. It was built in Louisiana. 7.5 tons of steel from the blown-up towers. A woman who whose husband died, or her brother died, a firefighter, died in that tragedy, said, quote, "It's a transformation from something really twisted and ugly. I'm proud that our military is using that steel," end quote. Another person who lost her husband, also a firefighter, was watching as it sailed in New York Harbor, and she said, according to the Associated Press, she said, "We have to remember it's a way to honor them." Another woman who did not lose someone in the collapse of the building said, quote, "I just thought it was important to see from that something else can come of it," she said, of the transforming the wreckage into a weapon of death. Isn't that what it, a Navy assault ship is? I don't get this. This stuff is so far beyond my ability to comprehend. I just... Another person who lost her husband said regarding the boat, "We have to remember it's a way to honor them, building an assault, a Navy assault ship." I don't know. Somehow I have come off the rails where it concerns this stuff. The mayor, Michael Bloomberg, was there and said, quote, "This ship is actually a physical representation of that spirit with steel from the World Trade Center built into its bow. So every friend that sets foot on it and every foe that dares challenge it will feel its power and know that it is literally made from the heart and soul of the city that has sacrificed so much," end quote. I watched some of the video today from that and checked out what I was thinking and feeling as I watched it, and I just, you know, had to get real and realize that I didn't feel anything but confusion in watching this. You know, the slaughter of 3,000 people because of the incompetency, if not the deliberate withholding of protection by Cheney and Bush, the slaughter of all those people, and the result of that slaughter that Cheney spun into an attack, a military attack rather than a mission, a military attack on Afghanistan, and then the slaughter once again of Iraq. You know, all the lies, all the deceit, all the murder and blood and insanity and all the broken men and women that are coming back, all of it from that day, all of it, that's where it all came from. That was the excuse. As Bush said, he hit the trifecta. That's what the Project for New American Century was lobbying for way back during the Clinton years. This country, they said, needs another Pearl Harbor. You know, all of that, all of that. And then the suffering, the anguish of all the families who lost their family members on that day. And now metal from steel, from that collapse, that attack, has been hammered into a Navy assault ship whose sole function is to kill. And the Navy's assault ship is not produced in order to go places and build things and teach children and alleviate hunger and poverty. It is built specifically to kill and to carry on its decks helicopters that also have the capability of killing. I mean that's what it is. It's a Navy ship, for Christ's sake. It's not a, you know, it's not the good ship Lollipop. So I don't know. I'm probably the only person in America who looked at that today. Oh, maybe you did too, huh? You think, Truth Seeker? Who watched some of that video and thought, is this the way to commemorate the incompetency of the Bush-Cheney crime family that resulted in so much death? Is this the way to do it? It is 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Program. Regarding the World Trade Center steel being used to build this Navy assault ship, and, you know, the truly ambiguous feelings I had, I'm as much of a sucker for whatever the narrative is when American soldiers or firefighters or civilians are killed, just firefighters and civilians especially. My son was a firefighter for years, and it's, I'm sure you're the same way. Whenever that narrative is presented, I choke up, I get angry, I weep, I, you know, sniffle and try to make it get out of my head. When soldiers, even American soldiers who have been ordered into a situation where they have absolutely no chance of surviving and no reason being there, rather than hate the people that ordered them there, you know, I still get that sense of just complete helplessness, which, brings tears to my eyes. I don't know what it does to you, but that whole story about the steel being used in the construction of that ship, a couple of you have responded. KC writes, Mike, had they used that steel to make tens of thousands of solar stoves for Muslims who have no electricity to help them feed their families, then we would have made a statement about the heart of America. KC, well, I think we made a statement about the heart of America. We are a war-mongering country that is just can't seem to understand that we're involved in our own destruction in a real direct way. Reg writes, I'm horrified by the ship. Remember that every bit of steel and other rubble from the towers was a crime scene. It was all crime scene evidence. It was discarded immediately. Seeing this warship that has come out of the ashes of that terrible day is nothing more than a reminder of the success of those who either orchestrated or allowed the attacks. To take such pride in our military strength is a reminder of the hubris and arrogance that define the Bush years. I cannot look at the ship without dread. And Kate writes, I heard the ship story on BBC an hour before your airtime. I had to, quote, sit on my hands, end quote, to keep from writing you a scathing letter, whatever. I'm shocked. I'm appalled. I'm saddened. I wish I had the time and energy to write an ironic essay, but not today. Even more amazing to me, all that wreckage was hauled away before forensics could be done on the crime scene. If I wore a dress, I'd pull it over my head and ran in circles around the room screeching. You feel sanity slipping away too? Kate. Yeah, it's just, you know, the ambiguousness that you can't help but feel unless you're just a blind, brain-dead, so-called patriot, and that word has been totally bastardized. They don't feel that. Or if you have completely thrown in the towel and just look at stuff like that and just say whatever. If you fall between those extremes, how can you not be emotionally jerked around yet again? I swear that I, you know, since I could never, I would kill myself before I would ever allow myself to even think for a moment that these right-wingers are anything other than swine, scum, filth. But I've gotten to the point where I'm wishing that I could get into the other extreme and just look at stuff like that and say, whatever. You know, and switch over to, you know, History Channel or Science Channel if I'm watching television, or if I'm reading the paper, just kind of read it and adopt a, no offense to Buddhists, but adopt kind of a Buddhist attitude of, oh, okay, you take note and let it go. As far as Afghanistan, Fareed Zakaria, who has a program, I think it's called GPS on CNN, had an interview with Matthew Ho. He's the... Dave sent this to me. Matthew Ho is the Foreign Service officer who resigned last week from his post in Afghanistan. And let me share some of the Q&A between Fareed Zakaria and Matthew Ho. Zakaria. Matthew Ho's young Foreign Service officer resigned this week from his post in Afghanistan. He joins me now. Matthew, I'm going to just start by reading a bit from your resignation letter. You say, quote, I fail to see the worth or value in continued U.S. casualties or expenditures of resources in support of the Afghan government in what is truly a 35-year-old civil war, end quote. And then you go on to say, quote, thousands of our men and women have returned home with physical and mental wounds, the dead return only in bodily form, to be received by families who must be reassured that their dead have been sacrificed for a purpose worthy of such futures, lost, love vanished, and promised dreams unkept. I have lost confidence such assurance can any more be made, and as such, I submit my resignation, end quote. Zakaria, those are very strong words. Give us some sense of what this insurgency that we're fighting looks like. What did you think people were fighting U.S. troops for? Matthew Ho, who is a former Marine captain and U.S. State Department official. Answer. The first place where I really had, where this was codified for me and where I started to understand what we were doing and how we were involved, was in the Korengal Valley, which I'm sure a lot of your viewers are familiar with. It's been on the cover of Time magazine. The New York Times refers to it as the Valley of Death. Off the top of my head, unfortunately, I can't remember how many American soldiers we've lost there. It's probably 30 or 40. It's a valley. I don't know, 15, 20 kilometers long. There's only 10,000 people in it. They speak their own language. They speak Korengali. In the year 2009, we have a valley with people who speak their own language. Their only trade is the timber trade. And when they move their timber, they don't even leave their valley. Most of the time, I believe, they just take it over to the Mazar Valley, and a middleman picks it up and brings it to Pakistan for them. So we show up. We enter their valley. We occupy the richest man's timber mill. And then we bring in Afghan army and Afghan police who aren't from there. And then what do? Then we have the Afghan police and Afghan army say to the Korengalis, they say, quote, these mountains here that your families have been cutting trees down, sustaining yourself for hundreds of years, you don't own them. The central government does, and you have to pay tax on that, end quote. I'm not sure how many people anywhere else in the world wouldn't take up arms against something like that. End quote. Yeah, well, that's, you know, we've talked about that on this program. What would you do, Truth Seeker? If you're a Republican, you're a filthy coward and a sneak and a liar, so you would wet your pants and run into the woods or immediately go to the invader and say, hey, I'll be on your side. But if you really believe in some of the stuff that we've been taught to believe in, if you believe in some of the stuff that we haven't been taught that is basic, elemental, instinctual survival stuff, then you would fight like a son of a bitch against an invader. You would fight like the Vietnamese fought against us and defeated us. You would fight like crazy until you finally got rid of these people who had come into your country and were telling you what you would and would not do and forcing an illegitimate government down your throat. Which brings us to Afghanistan. The Abdullah, the person who had the election stolen from him, has decided to back out of a runoff. There's not going to be a runoff. As a matter of fact, today, the so-called election commission in Afghanistan proclaimed Hamid Karzai the victor in the election 2.5 months ago. So that's all over. So now, here we are. The Obama administration is telling American soldiers, men and women, that they must go now into a combat zone and risk their own death, their own physical maiming, their psychological destruction, for a government that the people of Afghanistan rejected. Now, how in the hell do you do that?
Entering a flying monkey free zone.
21 past the hour. So the so-called election commission in Afghanistan has decided that President Hamid Karzai is the victor after the theft, the fraud, the same thing that happened in this country in 2000, 2.5 months ago in Afghanistan. Abdullah, former foreign minister, announced he was pulling out. He said the new ballot that was scheduled for November 7th would not have been fair and accused the Karzai-appointed Independent Election Commission of bias. Yeah, the election committee, this is like Dick Cheney, who was appointed by George W. Bush to find him a vice presidential candidate. You know, a goddamn filthy totalitarian is a goddamn filthy totalitarian. It doesn't make any difference if he's in Afghanistan or in Texas. But the Obama administration has commended the ruling by the Karzai-appointed election commission. Quote, "We congratulate President Karzai on his victory in this historic election and look forward to working with him to support and improve security," end quote. That's a statement the U.S. Embassy issued. Britain and the United Nations also issued statements of congratulations. What do you do with that? You and I both know. We know. We absolutely know, as did the whole world. How long ago was it that the United Nations, the United States and Britain and all kinds of countries and around the planet were demanding a new election in Afghanistan because it was clear to even you and me, who have absolutely nothing to do with this nonsense. Here we sit, except it's taking our sons and daughters and our money. Here we said, even we knew about it. We knew it was a fraud. We knew it was a goddamn scam, as did everybody else. And now all of a sudden, the scam is gone. Why is the scam gone? Why has it all been removed? Because Abdullah said, look, this is going to be another fraud. I'm out of here. And now the Obama administration commends the ruling of the Election Commission. The Election Commission says Harman Karzai, is the winner. The Election Commission says that because the challenger pulled out. So the fraud stands. The lies stand. We, once again, are backing a government that the majority of people in Afghanistan want no part of. Now, how many American soldiers and Marines are going to goddamn die because of this? How many are going to have arms and legs blown off? How many more of those pictures are you and I going to see of little 5 and 6 year old kids waiting for daddy to come home, and he comes home with his face so distorted because half his skull is gone and he can't even say his child's name because of this decision? Son of a bitch. The U.S. statement said that the commission's decision to declare Harman Karzai the winner was in line with its, quote, mandate under Afghan law, end quote. A spokesman for Abdullah, however, said the decision did not reflect Afghan law, but declined to say if the candidate would challenge it. A spokesman for Abdullah said, quote, "The announcement that was made by the Electoral Commission today will not solve the problems of Afghanistan, and it doesn't have any basis in law," end quote. The spokesman for Abdullah said Abdullah would give his reaction in a speech tomorrow. Ronald Newman, a retired U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, said canceling the runoff was the country's best available option and that few were likely to contest the decision. Newman said, quote, "It's over. He withdrew. Karzai wins. I think we are much more hung up than they will be on these rules." Oh, my God. So, regarding the ship that was made from the steel harvested from the collapsed trade towers, Alice in Arkansas writes, "No, you're not the only one. No, you haven't gone off the rails. The dominant culture has gone off the rails. Building a ship of death from the steel from the trade towers to, quote, honor the victims, end quote, is just another step down the path to militant cultural insanity. When I read of the ship of death, the only thing I thought was, how are the hundreds of thousands of lives of the Iraqis being commemorated? Do their families, villages, country have the time and resources to make sure that what has happened to them is never forgotten? Are they their names read off every year on the anniversary of Shock and Awe?" Alice in Arkansas.
Against the Flying Monkey Right with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, the letter, Captain Howe's resignation letter, we talked about it the week it came out, which was last week, as a matter of fact. And as Reg points out, when it did come out, it was, surprise, surprise, ignored by corporate media. Reg writes, "I watched the Zakaria program on Sunday, and I'm glad to know there were at least four of us watching. Zakaria is a strong supporter of war as a solution to problems, so this was a welcome change. Captain Ho wasn't important enough to make it on Larry King. Maybe if he had put the letter in a runaway balloon. Point taken. Regarding the steel in the ship, USS New York, Tom in San Diego, Mike, you're not alone in thinking that building a war machine out of Twin Tower steel is inappropriate. It may not have been a bad idea to build an aircraft carrier or destroyer in 1943 out of steel from the USS Arizona and then use that ship to fight Japan in the Pacific. Pearl Harbor was a deliberate attack by a sanctioned government. We subsequently and appropriately declared war on this government. But there are no parallels here. 9/11 was initiated by a loose collection of individuals with box cutter knives. Is a Navy assault ship an appropriate response to this? I do not expect, however, that Joe Sixpack would be able to make this differentiation, so you and I and some other Progressive Talk listeners will be the minority here. We should have built a hospital in New York with the steel. Tom in San Diego. And Tom somewhere else writes regarding that Navy assault ship. It's because of the views you're expressing that I find you one of the very few people who's heard in the media that I can relate to. I've had the exact same attitude about war implements since I grew out of my childhood fascination with John Wayne and combat and cap gun fights with my friends. Voices like yours were never heard in the media during Vietnam and subsequent actions of aggression by the World Empire. Perhaps that's a good thing. Perhaps that is one good thing about the present media climate. At least there's room for liberal voices, however few and on however weak a radio signal. On the other hand, it probably doesn't matter that you're there. The powers that be are already so firmly affixed that voices in the wilderness like yours are of no consequence to them. But keep it up, Mike. It's good to know there are others out there who have not been absorbed by the toxic propaganda that has indoctrinated this culture for decades. Yeah, and a lot of people feel that way. You know, I certainly don't mean to suggest that, you know, I've had some flash of insight. There are all kinds of websites that are saying essentially the same thing. Where do you think I steal half the material for this program? But, and individuals, I mean, people listen to this program. Millions of people feel that way. I think, for the most part, though, folks are so flummoxed, like, you know, what to do. We thought we were doing something when we elected the socialist communist, which is what these right-wing brain-dead asses call Barack Obama. Barack Obama is just kind of, he's turning out to be a well-spoken, kind of hip totalitarian himself, isn't he? I mean, do you disagree with that? Do you think he is really the progressive social democrat that we all had hoped? I mean, he never said he was. It was the resume that was kind of confusing. Community organizer. Remember, you know, Pontius Pilate was a governor. Jesus was a community organizer, right? Remember that bumper sticker? When the hoe from Wasilla was trying to act like she was important, the governor. But no, Obama never said he was going to withdraw from Afghanistan. He never said anything, really, that it was beautiful rhetoric. And I think a lot of progressives bought into it reluctantly because we weren't hearing specifics. We were hearing amorphous overviews, you know, that we were able to then fill in. And we did. And to our misfortune, we filled in things that weren't there. Just weren't there. So, still, it just kind of sets my teeth on edge. Doesn't it? Don't you feel like a fool? You know you do. You know you do. Tomorrow is supposed to be a referendum or several referenda on the Obama administration in the governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. And this hideous little circle jerk up in, is it the 23rd district in New York State? Hasn't that turned into just a bunch of people? I don't know. I don't know what they're doing. This is where the Republican has resigned from the race and thrown her support to the Democrat, and all the big guns are going for the conservative. There's a conservative party candidate now, a guy who doesn't even live in the district, who's an absolute right-wing insane. He's just out of his goddamn mind. He's just totally crazy. Therefore, all the big guns in the Republican Party love him. So, we'll see what happens tomorrow. Whew. Oh, by the way, when your kid or your niece or your nephew or whatever went trick-or-treating the other night, did you get any demon-saturated candy? You know, I'll be a son of a bitch. The demon-saturated candy that my five-year-old got tastes real good, you know? These little baby... I've got to stop eating them. These Baby Ruth candy bars... You know, that's what Pat Robertson's blog or website was talking about. Some crazed religious nutbag was talking about how the candy was being saturated with demons. Jesus, God. Ah! So,
Well, I did make devil's food cupcakes to take to her school, so... There is some truth to that.
Yeah, I think you have a different interpretation of that word, though. Prairie 2 writes in tonight, Friday was a busy day in the bank seizure business with the FDIC liquidating 9 underwater banks at a cost of $2.5 billion. This brings us to 115 bank seizures for the year. But to put this in a better historical perspective, you need to remember that many of those banks have dozens and some more than 100 branches. This amount of banking consolidation used to be illegal, so the comparison to past economic downturns just by number of banks is closing is deceptive. Things are much worse. Speaking of much worse, today after a long struggle, CIT, not Citi, but CIT has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Unlike the too big to fail Wall Street banks that are known as the 13 families, this really large bank does real business banking and is a driver of the real economy, CIT. They provide lines of credit to many of the small and medium businesses that you take for granted, but also to their suppliers, the business's suppliers. This could have even more far-reaching implications since they in turn provide goods and services on credit to small businesses that are not able to get extensive lines of credit on their own. In theory, with the prepackaged Chapter 11 proceedings that CIT is now under, they should be able to continue operations. But this is by no means certain. Even the months that this will take, if successful, will put a huge drag on the customers of CIT. If this plan fails, however, it would be the trigger for a retail sector collapse that could make the minor fluctuations in the economy we've experienced so far seem like the prosperous good old days. Consumer spending accounts for over 60% of the economy. Before the last year, it was 70%. But because of the call of Reaganomics converted us to a so-called service economy, the loss of thousands more retail businesses will cause unemployment to spike much higher and accelerate the downward spiral that we are already in. The uncertainty alone will make things worse and can lead to unexpected consequences. Economics, you see, is like alligators. It's the one you don't see that gets you. Prairie 2. All right, we have a break almost upon us. Something unusual I want to share with you when we come back from Friday's Crooks and Liars website. Susie Madrak wrote this. About the health insurance plan, reform plan, that seems to be the one that's going to make it through the House and the Senate. And it's very, very disturbing. This is not, you know, about death panels and, you know, granny's going to be kicked to the curb and all this nonsense that these right-wing pukes have put out there. This is real stuff. I'll share it with you when we come back. I'm Mike Molloy. Stay with us. Writing at Crooks and Liars. She writes, if the House and Senate are forced to water down the public option to, say, negotiated rates in the House and a Senate trigger, liberals will have a much weaker negotiating position in the Senate House Conference Committee. So look for liberal pressure groups to work on moderate Democrats big in coming days as it becomes increasingly clear that the public options epilogue could be cast in the debate's first chapters. She says, in the meantime, I finally located the numbers for premium subsidies, or as they're called in the bill, affordability credits. Here they are, and as I thought, the numbers simply aren't realistic. The bill provides financial assistance on a sliding scale. Premiums range from 1.5% of income to 12% of income for those at 400% of the poverty, federal poverty level. The plan provides additional assistance for households up to 400% of the federal poverty level by limiting cost sharing. Yada, 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 yada. It goes on and on. And when you get down to the bottom line of what this so-called health insurance reform actually is, it comes down to, here's an example. For families with more than eight persons, this insurance reform will add $3,700 a year for each additional person. And as Susie Madrick writes, so although I've been unemployed, on unemployment for the past year, I would be expected to pay approximately $4,000 a year for health insurance. Your individual mileage may vary, but those figures aren't very reassuring to me. I'm looking at this. You'll have to. This is at wonkette.com. No, not there. It's at Crooks and Liars. Susie Madrack. She wrote it on Friday, and if you, it's too complicated for me to try to read it, share it with you on the air. But the bottom line, what it looks like to me is that the so-called health insurance reform, As it has been bastardized by the insurance industry in both the House and the Senate, is going to come down to, first of all, forced insurance, which the insurance industry is just licking its chops. They can't wait for this. I don't know what to think anymore. The solution to this, of course, is to have a public option. Or maybe this is the public option. I don't know. I have no idea. I wash my hands of it. I really, I'm at that point. It's just meaningless to me. You know, after what was perpetrated against us all this past summer, by the right-wing crazy bastards with the town hall meetings that could have been forums for understanding or questioning what this is all about. These town hall so-called meetings that representatives conducted or tried to conduct when they went back to their home districts, and I'm not talking about these right-wing pigs, I'm talking about real representatives of the people, if such a thing exists. That might be a joke on me too. But if they had been conducted with the idea of trying to A, educate the voters on what was in the works, and B, educate the members of Congress as to what the voters wanted. You know, in other words, a back and forth, logical, reasonable, rational discussions, which we don't have in this country anymore about anything on any level. Are you aware of that? There is no rational discussion about the issues facing us in this country anywhere. Except maybe, perhaps, in academia. Maybe there are still some hallways and meeting rooms where academics can get together or students can get together and quietly discuss things and try to find solutions. I don't know, man, but it's certainly not in the public discourse. It's not there anymore. It doesn't exist. It's not there. So what's the point in trying, and seriously, I mean this, trying to convince ourselves that what is going to come out of the House and the Senate, I don't care how much Nancy Pelosi licks her lips or Harry Reid rubs his hands together, it's going to be puke. It's going to be nothing. It's going to be worse than nothing because it will be crushing the promise that, or the thought of a promise that some of us had. But here again, you know, we probably deceived ourselves, just like we deceived ourselves about Barack Obama. Single payer was never even entered into the discussion. Never. And you gotta wonder why. You know? Why it was not clearly explained to the American people. Okay, people, it's like Medicare. Only everybody will have a chance at it. And it's not free. You have to pay for it. It'll cost you, what does Medicare cost? Social Security recipients? $110, $120 bucks a month, somewhere like that, right? That it's going to cost you money. It's only going to be 80%, so you're going to have to figure out some way to deal with that 20%. But we're going to work towards a full single-payer healthcare system. But here, right at the beginning, it's just going to be Medicare for everybody, okay? And that could have been explained. And Barack Obama, using the bully pulpit, and the liberals in Congress should have got behind him and said, okay, this is what we're going to do. And they should have, you know, armed themselves. And when the lobbyists from the insurance industry showed up, just gun them down in the streets, right? Or in the hallways. Just, you know, set up your BAR and open fire. Oh, look, here they come. Here come the lobbyists. No? Yes? We'll be back after the break. We're going to take some phone calls, so if you want to join in, 877-996-2556. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. This is kind of disturbing. It's from the AP medical writer. Nearly half of all U.S. children and 90% of black youngsters will be on food stamps at some point during childhood. And fallout from the current recession could push those numbers even higher, according to researchers. How could it be higher than that? The estimate comes from an analysis of 30 years of national data, and it bolsters other recent evidence of the pervasiveness of youngsters at economic risk. This report suggests that almost everyone knows a family who has received food stamps or will in the future, said lead author Mark Rank, a sociologist at Washington University in St. Louis. The analysis was released today in the November issue of Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine. The authors say it's a medical issue pediatricians need to be aware of because children on food stamps are at risk for malnutrition and other ills linked with poverty. The lead author said, quote, "This is a real danger sign that we as a society need to do a lot more to protect our children," end quote. For a family of four to be eligible for food stamps, their annual take-home pay can't exceed about $22,000. According to a USDA report released last month, 28.5 million Americans received food stamps in an average month in 2008, and about half were younger than 18. The editorial of the medical journal that this report came out of, come out in the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, an editorial. The editorial said, quote, "The current recession is likely to generate for children in the United States the greatest level of material deprivation that we will see in our professional lifetimes," end quote. That's Stanford pediatrician Dr. Paul Weiss. He also wrote, "I find it terribly sad, but not surprising." James Weil, president of Food Research and Action Center, a Washington-based advocacy group, said the analysis underscores that, quote, "there are just very large numbers of people who rely on this program for a month, 6 months, a year," end quote. He goes on to say, quote, "what I hope comes out of the study is an understanding that food stamp beneficiaries aren't them, they're us," end quote. Jesus, God. This analysis, the article goes on, is in line with other research suggesting that more than 40% of U.S. children will live in poverty or near poverty by age 17. And the half will at some point live in a single-parent family. Also, other researchers have estimated that slightly more than half of adults will use food stamps at some point by age 65. Well, okay. I mean, I don't know how spooky this is. Let's see. I used food stamps in 1976. Of course, I was single at the time, and probably didn't need to get them, but they were available. I've kind of regretted that until, you know, somebody told me, "Are you kidding? This has nothing to do with taking them away from somebody else. These are from the Department of Agriculture, yada yada." but as an adult with a family, no. I've never done that. But this report is saying that half of children across the spectrum, nearly half of all U.S. children, and 90% of African-American youngsters will be on food stamps at some point during childhood. Why? This is a part that another little piece of the puzzle that makes me just feel like I'm living in an asylum. When numbers like that come out, why isn't there an immediate outcry by people who are in power in this country? I know the answer to this. I'm just blowing smoke, you know, at my own body orifice. Why isn't there a media outcry from people in power in this country, educators, nutritionists, government officials, who say, no, 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 this can't happen, no, and take all this money that's going to be used? What did we say the other night? It's $1 million. Is it $1 million per soldier per year or something to go to Afghanistan? Enough money per soldier per year in Afghanistan to build 20 schools in Afghanistan. Screw the schools in Afghanistan. How about right here? How about taking this statistic and shredding it? I mean, just destroy it. How do you do that? Well, first you have to provide nutritional support to kids who need it. Food stamps. Aren't there all kinds of restrictions on food stamps? Jesus Christ, this is madness. It really is. It's oh, Jesus. You know, you start laughing. One starts laughing, at least I do, so that I don't start screaming and crying. I mean, this is insane. This is madness. Why aren't we... Oh, my God, I get so sick of asking these questions. Why aren't we working... I mean, there's a good way to put all 15 million of the Americans who are unemployed right now back to work. Within, I don't know, 30 days. Very simply, start a WPA-style bureaucracy in this country. Works Project Administration, whatever the hell it was, back in the 30s. It wasn't make work. It was good work. It was bridges, dams, parks, roadbeds, railroads, schools, you know, the infrastructure. And now, with these hundreds of thousands of miles of expressways that we interstates that we put down since the 50s, it all needs repair. Everything needs repair. Everything. I mean, there is no way in hell that we couldn't have everybody back to work. And then it would lessen, at least lessen, it might eliminate the fact that half of all children are going to wind up on food stamps. What in the hell does that statistic mean? I mean, why is that not causing us all to just go berserk? Like, what? What the hell are you talking about? This is the United States of goddamn America. We are the U.S. USA! USA! You know, that group, you know? We build warships out of steel from buildings that have collapsed because of the President of the United States and his crime family allowed it to happen. We have half of our children going to be on food stamps? What is this? Where in the hell do we live? I don't give a rat's ass about the election in the 23rd Congressional District in New York tomorrow. Do you? And I don't give a damn who's the governor of Virginia. It's going to be a right-winger. I don't care who's the governor of New Jersey. It's going to be a right-winger. But what I do care about is this report that says, you know, half of children in this country are going to wind up on food stamps. And what do we do about it? Oh, man. We have a break coming here. This is a quote from Major General Mike Flynn, Director of Intelligence for General Stanley McChrystal, who is the head honcho in Afghanistan. The expansion of Islamic extremist groups across the Afghanistan-Pakistan region is, quote, the worst I've seen it, end quote, with Afghan insurgents receiving help from Iranian operatives and, quote, very possibly freelancing Pakistani intelligence agents, as well as a small but growing number of, quote, deadly foreign fighters, said Major General Mike Flynn, Director of Intelligence for General Stanley McChrystal. Worst I've seen. Insurgency in Afghanistan has grown tenfold, and this is directly the fault of Dick Cheney and George Bush. Directly.
Oh,
just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Let's do some phone calls here. Nan is in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on XM. Hey, Nan.
Hi, Mike. I don't know if you actually have talked about this already, but one of the hugest lies that the Democrats are promoting about this new health care bill is the amount of people that they're saying are going to have access to medical care. And it's the number of people that they're going to throw onto the Medicaid roster. And throughout the United States, there's only 27% of physicians, primary care physicians, that accept Medicaid patients, and that's Medicaid for children. Mm-hmm. The number for Medicaid adults is even less. So you're going to take all these people that don't have medical care now, put them on the Medicaid roster, and they're still not going to have care because within the medical community, anyone who accepts Medicaid patients is more, by and large, is seen as a badge of shame to accept Medicaid patients.
What's the way to handle this?
Excuse me?
What would be a better way to handle people who are so poor that they normally would, you know, qualify for Medicaid?
Well, I don't know, but putting them on the Medicaid list, is they're not going to have access to care on that either.
Right, I understand. So do you have an idea what would be, a better way to provide medical care to these people and payment to the doctors that would serve them?
Well, I had a physician in, and I asked him why there was such an aversion to accepting Medicaid when their reimbursement for Medicaid is actually better than reimbursement for HMOs.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that one reason was because the paperwork for Medicaid was a nightmare.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And then he said, dealing with an HMO is actually less of a nightmare than dealing with the Medicaid.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's I didn't know that. You would think, wouldn't you, that it would be simpler. It would just be very simple. Just treat the patient, check the schedule of how much you can charge, send it in, get your
right.
check.
Especially since they receive more for Medicaid than they do HMOs.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that it is considered a something to be ashamed of if you accept a Medicaid patient.
A doctor say that?
Oh, yeah. Ask anybody in the medical profession. You're looked down upon if you accept a Medicaid patient. You only accept Medicaid when you can't make it in the real world with real patients.
Well, I would question that a little bit, Nan. Hey, Nan, thank you. I got to move on. I appreciate your comments. That's something I truly didn't know. But I would question... You know, I don't know how physicians see Medicaid patients. I do know, like Nan said, a lot of physicians will not take a Medicaid patient. Molly's pediatrician takes Medicaid patients, doesn't she? Yeah, she takes Medicaid patients. And she's just one hell of a good doctor as far as I'm concerned. She's had control of... Molly's health issues, well, we've had control of it, but you know what I'm saying. She has been in charge of Molly's health care issues since Molly was 2 weeks old. And anytime we go in there, into her office for a well baby checkup or whatever they call it, or a vaccination, or I think maybe once when Molly had... a cold. I think this kid has only had one or two colds in her entire life. But anytime we've gone in there, there are lots of poor kids in there with you know, a single mom or an auntie, somebody raising her, grandma. That's just, you know, the practice. But Molly's pediatrician would no more turn these folks down, you know, or not be their doctor. Under any circumstances. of course, she, you know, strongly recommends that, you know, that kids and adults, although she's a pediatrician, eat lots of vitamin D, lots of B6, lots of C, lots of calcium. You know, she's a firm believer in preventive medicine, believe it or not. I know. She's also a firm believer in vaccinating children against diseases, too. All right, we have a break coming here. We'll come back and take some more phone calls here in just a moment. But, you know, I don't mean to single out Molly's pediatrician. I'm sure there are, that's the only one I know of, though. The only pediatrician I know of, and it's the one Molly goes to, and she's more than willing to take care of kids on Medicaid, whether it's the S-CHIP program. Well, I guess that is Medicaid, isn't it? Peach Care is what they call it here in Georgia. We'll be back right after the break. Stick around. We'll take your phone calls when we come back. I'm Mike Mobley.
Here's the truth speaker, Mike Mobley.
Twenty-five before the hour. Let me drop this in. This is from Ryan. Hey, Mike, I just tried to call, but it was disconnected. Maybe it was my phone. Anyway, just wanted to say that I'm hopeful for the future of America. Maybe it's because I'm young and I haven't lived through most of this country's history. I'm a 23-year-old recent college graduate, and perhaps I've been living in a bubble the last 4 years. Maybe you felt the way I do when you were my age. Here is what I think is different. Information is available. If not for the internet, I think we would have been swallowed up and spit out by the corporate machine by now. But in an age where information is traveling faster than ever, I carry a glimmer of hope that a tipping point will be reached and people will come out of their slumber. Again, maybe I'm naive, but you have to fight, right? With hope, Ryan. No, I completely agree with that, Ryan. I've said before that I still retain hope in, well, your generation. And the technology that you're right, that is available. That's why, you know, for sure, around the planet, look at the countries that try to restrict access to the web. It's not because of sexual explicitness. It's not because of religious freedom. It's not because of, it's because if you don't control the flow of information, you control nothing. And if you do control the flow of information, you control everything. So, I hope you're right, Ryan. And if I do have hope, and I do, it's grounded in your generation. You know, people who fall in the age group from 15 to 30. Good luck. Seriously. You know, by the time you are 25 years into your effort, people my age, for the most part, won't be around to witness what you have accomplished or are still trying to accomplish. But no, I have a lot of hope in people your age. Kevin is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey.
Called in earlier to talk about healthcare, but when you're talking about the flow of information, that brings up a whole other topic.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, recently there's been some controversy as far as how Fox News has been being one-sided. And
Wait. You know, what controversy? It's a fact.
Well, recently there was going to be a White House briefing, and that Fox was not going to be allowed to attend.
That's not true. Who told you that?
That was on... Well,
it's
pretty much all over the
news. No, it wasn't. You're crazier than a loon. Go away. Frank is in Illinois. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Mike. I just wanted to call in and comment about the electoral frivolity going on in Afghanistan. I got to believe that George Bush is just green with envy this evening, or has been for a day or two now, because Hamid Karzai didn't even have the... common decency to pull a nylon stocking over his head before he stuck up the candy store.
Yeah, not the truth.
And secondly, I don't think that Mr. Abdullah did what he did for all those altruistic reasons that he was saying. I got to believe that he was taken out to dinner one night by people from KBR and Schlumberger and ExxonMobil, and they told him the story of a gentleman named John Fitzgerald Kennedy, I think, and I think that probably changed his mind.
Or, if not John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the person who was assassinated 3 months, 4 months before Kennedy, and that was Ngo Dinh Diem in South Vietnam. And
him too.
Yeah, and Kennedy, I heard some weird little slices of audio tonight. It was on... Brian Williams, NBC Nightly News, of Kennedy and his advisors back in 63, in the spring of 63, before Diem was assassinated, before Kennedy was assassinated, talking about with his advisors about the fact that people were going to die. They didn't know what to do about Diem, yada, yada, yada. So, I think you've hit on two nails on the head there. Abdullah is not a fool, I don't think. I mean, I don't know him from Adam's house cat, but all of a sudden he says, "Look, I'm out of here. It'll just be fraud again." I think he knows what happens when you challenge. You know, when the United States says, "Okay, here's your leader," and you challenge that, watch out.
Yeah, I think he's a lot smarter than we're giving him credit for.
I tend to agree with you.
All right, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Frank. Thanks. Drive safely. Appreciate you checking in. If you heard those little snippets of audio on NBC Nightly News tonight, it was very interesting to hear what JFK had to say about the developing situation. Now, remember, this is 63. This is before the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. This is before massive buildup of U.S. troops in South Vietnam. But the discussion was all about... It was oblique, you know, it was indirect, but it was all about, okay, Diem is the president, and his brother is a thug and a thief and a con artist. I'm putting my own words here. That's not what was on the tape. But all of that was true. And how, given the situation in South Vietnam in 1963, how is Diem going to survive? And the answer that came back from the experts, and Kennedy accepted this, was that the odds were he wasn't going to. He wasn't going to survive. Well, he damn sure wasn't going to, you know, just die of a heart attack. He was going to be murdered. He was going to be assassinated. So in, what was it, June, July, August, 63, Diem was assassinated. November, Kennedy was assassinated. I think that's correct. I think maybe Abdullah was talked to. They had a sit down, as he used to say in the neighborhood, a nice sit down where things were explained. You know, okay, you had your moment. We had to steal it from you, but you make us steal it again, and we will kill you. It's just very simple. If we have to steal it from you again, we will goddamn kill you. Now, what do you want, Mr. Abdullah? I think I'll live. Good choice. Good choice. Good. When do you make your speech? Now, we'll see what Abdullah says tomorrow. Tomorrow is when he's supposed to make the official withdrawal speech or whatever it is that he's going to say. But in that part of the world, just like in this part of the world, they don't like people who pop up out of the woodwork and declare themselves candidates of the people. Two words, Benazir Bhutto, you know? No. No. The totalitarian government in place, usually backed by the United States, will decide not just who the candidates are, but who the winners are. And you want to dispute that, it's very iffy for the future of you continuing to breathe, if you know what I mean. And I think Abdullah knew what was being said. Yeah. Mike is in Chicago listening online. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm all right. How you doing?
First of all, have I mentioned how much I hate Joe Lieberman tonight?
Oh, my God, is this guy a piece of work? Boy.
But actually, the reason I was calling was I've got two bumper stickers I'm going to send out to you. And the first one says, hey, Fox, if you're so fair and balanced, have Mike Malloy fill in for O'Reilly.
Oh, no. I would never do that. I would open a vein first, Mike. I will not go near that putrid, filthy propaganda machine. All right, what's the other one?
The other one says, dear Mr. President, Ted Kennedy would be ashamed of you.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
But the reason I wanted to thank you for all who did not listen to last Wednesday's show, when you plugged Vincent Bugliosi's website, Indiegogo.com /Bush,
yeah.
It's so awakening, those 9 minutes when you watch, and it's so sad to think of all the money him and Bob Alexander spent to distribute all those books, and no one even had the time of day to return a phone call to him.
Yeah, really.
And I called Stephanie's show, I called Rachel's show, and I called Tom Hartman's show today, and I went on the air and I plugged that website for everyone.
Good.
So
that's
hopefully
great.
That'll do something come next February, you know?
When the movie's released.
Yeah. But you know what? No one has ever asked this question. Why didn't any of these Republicans cry out about government control when Bush was shredding the Constitution?
Because...
Did you ever notice that? No one, not even Chris Matthews, Oberman.
Yeah, they're in... Well, the Republicans, the fascists are in favor of it. They just don't... They want it to be their guy, you know? They just want it to be their guy. Hey, Mike, thanks.
All right, thanks, Mike. Talk to you soon.
Okay, take care. We'll be right back. Sharon, Bruce, Kay, Bob, and of course our executive producer, Kathy Day. Prairie 2, who also knows about things military, sent me an email regarding the SS New York. He writes, ironically, an amphibious transport dock like the LPD-21 USS New York... That's the full name. Is the perfect... Oh, that's the one that's built with the steel from the collapsed trade towers. Is the perfect humanitarian relief vessel with fully equipped surgical theaters, helicopter deck, and inboard well for boat docking, It can offload hundreds of tons of relief supplies and vehicles in a few hours without needing a dock. This level of relief support, this is a level of relief support that is hard to accomplish in a remote theater. Not surprisingly, nobody would spend $1 billion for one of these if it were called a peace ship. This is the fifth in the series so far. So I got that and I wrote back. So its construction was a good thing? Just asking. And Pray2 responds, it would be good if it wasn't the center of a multi-warship task force that cost more billions and still more billions to operate, and it will rarely, if ever, be used for anything but intimidating third world countries into submitting to U.S. corporate domination, right up until they inadvertently clash with a Chinese warship and start World War III. So just when I think that Pray2 has sent me something that can make me go, yay, okay, yeah, he comes back with too much reality. Way too much reality. Oh, my God. One last thing here as we're getting ready to head out the door. This is from the L.A. Times today, I believe. Yeah, today. A little noticed measure in the health care insurance reform provision would put Christian Science healing prayer sessions on the same footing as clinical medicine. LA Times says, backed by some of the most powerful members of the Senate, a little notice provision in the health care overhaul bill would require insurers to consider covering Christian Science prayer treatments as medical expenses. The provision was inserted by Senator Orrin Hatch with the support of John Kerry and Ed Kennedy, both of Massachusetts, which is home to the headquarters of the Christian Science cult. I added the word cult. The measure would put Christian Science prayer treatments, which substitute or supplement medical treatments, on the same footing as clinical medicine. While not mentioning the church by name, it would prohibit discrimination against, quote, religious and spiritual health care, end quote. Well, I have a question regarding this. Now, I'm pretty sure that Christian Science believes in prayer as the primary form of healing. You pray that the person gets well. I don't know. I'm not all that familiar with Christian Science. I love their newspaper. I've been a steady reader of the Christian Science Monitor forever. I guess it's their newspaper. But I'm not real sure how Christian Science healing, so-called, works. I think it's all bogus, and I think it's in controlled studies. I think prayer and wailings and mumblings to sky spooks for healing has shown to be utterly ineffective. Matter of fact, has some negative aspects. But anyway, how do they charge for it? That's the point. That's the point I don't understand. If this is a Christian church, do they charge for sitting with somebody who's critically ill? Otherwise, why would health insurance be involved? I mean, if somebody wants to pray, if somebody wants to do a dance naked around an inverted chair as a means of religious worship, go ahead, have at it. But why is that included? I mean, do they charge for that? I'm going to come where you are. You are sick. I'm a Christian Science healer. Is that what they call it? Prayer healer? Whatever. Like I said, I don't know. But I'm going to pray over you. P.S. Here's my bill. What? I mean, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is that? What is that? My grandmother's Baptist church, they used to pray for people. I used to, as a little tiny kid, 5-6 years old, I used to go with my grandmother. It's kind of creepy, But this is thousands of years ago. When I was 5 years old, I used to go with my grandmother to the sick people's houses. And I have these old memories of sick people lying in these beds, and my grandma and a couple of her church cohorts praying. Okay, that's cool. I think that, you know, as far as I know, everybody died anyway. But I can't see my grandma submitting a bill then. What is this? What does this mean? I'll have to do some further research on this. The insurers have got to pay for faith healing or Christian healing or... Oh, my God. It's crazy. Crazy out there. It's a very good argument for just staying home. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.